You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 105. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, episode 105. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in the beautiful city of Los Angeles in the state of California, here on the beautiful west coast of the North American continent. This cafe is going to be about the metric system in the U.S., or why there is no metric system in the United States, why we still use feet and miles and pounds and so forth. We're also going to talk about the way people dress in different parts of the U.S., especially some of the differences between New York and Los Angeles. Remember, for a complete transcript and learning guide to this episode, go to our website at ESLPOD.com. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. One question that many people have when they visit or come to the United States is why the U.S. doesn't use the metric system of kilometers and deciliters and meters, the various ways of measuring things. This is an interesting question because actually the U.S. tried to convert from its current system of what we might call weights and measures, the units that we use to measure things. Several years ago, back in 1875, the U.S. was one of the original 17, what we would call signatory nations. The word signatory comes from signature, which is when you put your name on an official document or on a letter. So the U.S. back in the late 19th century was going to join the rest of the world in this scientific metric system. However, it was very difficult to get people to change. In the late 1960s, the U.S. government established or appointed a commission, a group of people to study this issue. And this commission recommended that the U.S. should convert to the metric system in 10 years. The reason was that the U.S. could be more competitive. When we say someone is competitive economically, we mean that they will be able to do better in business internationally if they would convert to the metric system. So the metric system, most Americans recognize, makes a lot of sense, is logical, is a much better system, I think, than the U.S. system. However, most Americans are not convinced that they should change their lifelong use of pounds and inches and gallons and so forth. Going back to history, in 1975, the U.S. government passed a law saying that we were going to convert to the metric system, and the metric system began to appear in many places in the U.S., in schools, they began to teach the metric system. When I was going through school, I was in grade school, elementary school, in 1975. I remember our teachers telling us that very soon, in another 5 or 10 years, everyone in the U.S. will be using the metric system. They also said that in 10 years, we would all be living on the moon. Well, neither of those things happened. We didn't live on the moon, and we didn't convert to the metric system. The problem was that although many businesses started to, for example, give the temperature in Celsius and in Fahrenheit, most people didn't pay a lot of attention. So while most students today in school still study the metric system, most people, I would say almost no one in the U.S., actually uses it in their daily life, except people in the sciences, scientists, and some businesses that do international trade. But the average American knows, for example, that a meter is a little longer than a yard, but can't really tell you how many centimeters are in a foot or what the difference is between a deciliter and a milliliter. A liter, Americans kind of understand because there are some things you can buy in a liter bottle, Coca-Cola, for example. But most Americans are not very used to and don't think they should become used to the metric system, even though it would help the U.S. economy. In fact, although Congress wanted to convert everyone to the metric system, the government wanted to convert everyone to the metric system in the 1970s, by 1982, 1983, there was very little official government support for the metric system. Will we ever convert to the metric system? Well, it makes sense. It's logical. But until people see that they have to do it, that it becomes absolutely necessary, I don't think it's going to happen any day soon. Perhaps we're just too lazy to switch. Our second topic today has to do with what you might call the dress code in LA and in New York. A dress code, two words, is a set of rules about how you should dress, what you should wear. Now, of course, there's no official dress code for most people, although some companies do have a dress code. Most schools have a dress code, rules about things that students can wear and cannot wear. But when we talk about a dress code in LA versus New York City, we're talking about what is common, what people typically wear. And there are real differences between these two cities. There was an article recently in the Wall Street Journal called Cracking the Dress Code in LA and New York. This is sort of a play on words. The expression to crack the code or a code means to figure out some sort of secret system. For example, two countries that are at war with each other might have their own code for communicating with their military officers. Someone who cracks the code figures out what the system is they're using to communicate. Well, here we're talking about figuring out the differences between the way people dress. The article says that in general, Los Angeles is much more relaxed, much less conservative, much more informal than New York. You might expect this if you watch American television shows or movies, they will often show people in Los Angeles dressed without a tie, for example, or not wearing a suit. In New York, it's much more common for business people to dress in a suit, for example, than in many businesses in LA. I'm sure there are many reasons for this, cultural and otherwise. It becomes a problem if you are going from New York to LA or LA to New York, and you don't understand that these are differences. If someone in LA, for example, goes to New York and doesn't wear a suit and a tie or dress formally, many people will say that that person is underdressed. To be underdressed means you're not formal enough. If you go to a wedding, for example, in shorts and a t-shirt, you will be underdressed, not appropriate. Similarly, when someone comes from New York to Los Angeles and wears a very formal business suit, in some places, they will say this person is overdressed. There's also an expression we have, to try too hard. They may say, oh, that person is trying too hard. To try too hard means to try to be someone that you're not, and it's obvious you're not. The article says, a man wearing a suit in Manhattan looks smart. In Silicon Valley or Southern California, the same look suggests he's trying too hard. He's trying to impress other people. And in the Silicon Valley, which is a part of Northern California, San Francisco, San Jose, those are cities that have a lot of computer-related companies. That's why it's called the Silicon Valley, since computer parts are often made out of silicon. In the Silicon Valley and in Southern California, the dress code is much more casual. The word smart here doesn't mean intelligent. It means good-looking. So someone will look smart in a suit in New York, but that will not be the same impression they give here in Los Angeles. LA dress style is informal, not in every company, but certainly in many companies involved in the, what we call here, the industry with a capital I. Sometimes you will see the entertainment industry. These are the people who make movies, television shows, record records, and so forth. There are many, many people in Los Angeles involved in this, except me. Although I do have a rock video, so I guess I'm part of the industry too. Now, of course, both Los Angeles and San Francisco have a financial sector. When we say a financial sector, S-E-C-T-O-R, we mean businesses that are related to banking and investment, for example. A sector is just a part of the economy. There could be the farm sector, the agricultural sector, the financial sector, and so forth. The podcast sector. No, I don't think there really is a podcast sector. But that's the idea of the word sector. So there are people who work in the financial sector who do have to dress more formally, just like they do back in New York. Now you might wonder, what about everyone in between California and New York? You have to understand that people who live in New York and who live in LA and in San Francisco have a tendency often think of themselves as being the most important people in the United States. They don't pay attention to, they tend to ignore everyone who lives in between LA and New York. There's an expression that people who live here know very well. It's called flyover country. The states in between California and New York are flyover country, meaning those are the states you fly over in an airplane as you're going from New York to Los Angeles. Of course, people who live on the West Coast and on the East Coast aren't the only people in the U.S. The dress code in the Midwest, for example, in Chicago, in Minneapolis, in St. Louis, perhaps, tends to be more conservative, much more like the way that people dress in Washington, D.C., for example, but it's not necessarily more formal than in New York, but definitely more formal than in L.A. I have to say the most informal city I have been to in terms of the way people dress in the U.S. is Honolulu, Hawaii. In Hawaii, you almost never see anyone with a tie on or a suit. Part of the reason is it is too hot, but part of the reason is that there's a very informal environment in Hawaii. In fact, even the governor and the senators don't wear a suit and tie in Honolulu, especially the governor, since it's a woman. Now let's answer a few of your questions. Our first question comes from Nicholas, N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S, in France. Nicholas wants to know the meaning of the word yutz, Y-U-T-Z. Yutz is actually not an English word, but a Yiddish word. Yiddish, Y-I-D-D-I-S-H, is a Germanic language. It has some similarities to German, but it's written in the Hebrew style, using Hebrew characters. Yiddish is associated with many people in the Jewish communities around the world, including in the U.S. Both Los Angeles and New York have large Jewish communities, so you will often hear certain Yiddish words that are part now of the regular vocabulary of people. Yutz is an example of a Yiddish word that many people use in English as well. Basically, a yutz is somebody who is not very good at relating to other people. We would say they have poor social skills. They're not very good at talking and listening to other people, or that there's something of a jerk, J-E-R-K. A jerk is someone who's not a very nice person. That's a yutz. There are actually many different Yiddish words that you will hear in the U.S., and we'll talk about that a different day in the cafe. Simkin, S-I-M-K-I-N, from Russia, wants to know the meaning of the expression to go back to square one. The expression to go back to square one means to begin again, something that you have started but failed to complete. So you try something, you attempt something, and you don't succeed, you fail. Someone may say, well, it's back to square one, meaning that idea or that approach didn't work. Now we have to start again, often using a different approach or a different strategy. For example, the cake I was making, and this is just an example since I don't make cakes, the cake I was making burned in the oven. So I have to go back to square one. I need to start all over again and make my cake. Jorge, J-O-R-G-E, in Mexico, has a good question about what we call people who are members of our family, different members of the family. His question is, what do I call, what name do I give someone who is the son of my cousin? Let's start with the word cousin. A cousin is the son or daughter of your aunt or uncle. So you and your cousins have the same grandparents,
either the parents of your mother or your father.
Well, in English, we don't really have, like many languages have, specific words for something like this. In normal conversation, you would call your cousin's son your cousin's son, or just your cousin. The word cousin is used very, you might say, liberally. We use it for lots of different relationships that are not brother, sister, son, daughter, and so forth. Now, in genealogy, which is the study of who your ancestors are, there is a more technical vocabulary, which I'll explain to you. However, this is not a vocabulary that most Americans know. So if you use this with an American, the typical American, they won't know what you're talking about, usually, for many of these expressions that I'm going to give you. I know only because my father was interested in genealogy and found out who all of our ancestors, or many of our ancestors, were. Now, someone who is the son and daughter of your aunt or uncle is called your cousin. You could also call them your first cousin. Your first cousins, remember, all have the same grandparents,
either on your mother's side or your father's side.
Your second cousins have the same great-grandparents, so they're a little more distant. In fact, that's another expression you'll hear. He's a distant cousin of mine. He's not a first cousin. He's not a cousin of my, a son or daughter of my aunt and uncle, but he is more distantly related. So you can have first cousins, second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins, and so forth. When you talk about son and daughter of your cousin, or grandsons and granddaughters of your cousins, we use a slightly different vocabulary. We use the word removed. Removed means a different generation. So my first cousins, many of them have children. They are my first cousins once removed. That means that they are still first cousins, but they're one generation younger than me. Your mother's first cousin would be your first cousin once removed. It doesn't matter if it's going down in generation or up in generation. We use this expression once removed, twice removed, and so forth. Again, this vocabulary about removed is not used in daily conversation. People do know, however, the difference between a first cousin and a distant cousin, but most people don't use the expression second cousin or third cousin. Mia, M-I-A, in Japan, has a question about the expression, I'm done with you. For example, when a girlfriend tells a boyfriend, her boyfriend, "I'm done with you," what does she mean? Well, she means that she's very angry, she's very upset, and she doesn't want to see the boyfriend again. The relationship is over. This is a very sad day for the boyfriend, or maybe a very happy day. It depends. Well, I'm not done with you, but I am done with this episode. If you have a question or comment, email us. Our email address is ESLPOD@ESLPOD.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say.
This podcast is copyright 2007 by the Center for Educational Development.